So the first thing to note, this picture is after Sandy. It's the Verizon data center, downtown New York. I can't remember exactly which street it's at. But if you see at the top of the screen, it says B, right? But there's actually stairs going down on the right side. Those stairs go down another three levels. And what they have here are a bunch of submersion pumps sitting on the landing and power cords running down. So at some point, somebody's going to have to walk down these stairs, pick up a 50-pound pump, and carry it down another flight of stairs in probably like 6 feet of standing water and put it down and then move on to the next floor when that's all done. And they're using fire hoses to evacuate the water. So luckily, none of our disasters are this bad, but it's a kind of cool picture, so I put it up here. So let's look at some other disasters in the past. We've had, 1906 San Francisco earthquake. We've had, this is a picture of Chernobyl back in the 80s. This should have music, but I didn't really feel like picking a score. This is Fukushima Daiichi, so you can see, how much worse this was than Chernobyl. That's another picture, Fukushima Daiichi. Guys like dumping water in through that boom crane to try to quench the fires that are going on. This is a picture of Sandy at a Hoboken yard for taxis. We've got another picture of Sandy with like boats around the houses just sitting in people's yards. This is also Sandy. You can see the houses are basically washed off their foundations. That's all sand. It's just like totally destroyed. And then we get more topical. We see data center and somebody had a little bit of a leak underneath. And then this is a disaster because that's a Ferrari. So that's just really sad. Some disasters are man-made. And some disasters are company-made. Yeah, right. There's a series of pictures here. These are actual pictures. The eWeek article there's a data restoration company who gets these machines from clients saying, hey, can you restore the data off of my hard drive, right? And the miracle of these pictures is these are the success stories. They actually got data. There's like a little hard drive right there. That's a Mac store. They got data off of that thing. So these are pretty talented. And some people have a love-hate relationship with technology. I can understand that. And then, some disasters are self-inflicted. And et cetera. So. Uh-oh. Blank screen. Oh, there we are. So at the last minute, I actually decided to change the title of the talk to be a little bit more topical with current events. So here we are. So the first issue, we had a degraded WAN. A little bit of diagnostics here. How do we know we had a degraded WAN? Well, we have automatic failover, as most people do. But we notice a spike, and this is representative of that spike. It's not actually representative of the particular event, but it's similar in nature. This is a smoke ping graph, and you can see that the latency goes from sort of the normal 11 milliseconds, a little bit of loss, a little bit of jitter, up to 22 milliseconds. And we recognize that as a failover to our backup path, which is a VPN connection between the primary data center and our office space, which are about 200 miles apart. So let's look a little bit at how we sort of figure these things out. These are useful things to know, your measures. Here's another smoke ping graph. And this is a different wide area network failure. What we have here is it's going from 11 milliseconds, pretty steady, up to a very steady 52 milliseconds. So we look at this, and this keeps happening to us over the course of actually a year with this provider. Like every time we have an OC12 failover, we keep the same bandwidth, but our latency goes to 52 milliseconds. And we're thinking, that's a lot. Really, that's a lot. So where exactly is 52 milliseconds. We want to go back to the carrier and say, why are you using this path? This path sucks. We're in the Northeast. We have lots of bandwidth. There's density. There's Boston. There's Rochester. There's Washington, D.C. There's Baltimore. They're all like heavily interconnected. Why are we doing 52 milliseconds? But in order to ask this question, we had to figure out, we wanted to get a little bit more, you know, ammo. So we did some investigations. So where is 52 milliseconds? Well, it turns out through my previous company, Global Crossing, I had access to these things called polars, which were used for all the wide area network SNMP data collection that they used for billing stats to bill customers. And these things are kind of public. So if you know the host name, you can ping it. And they each have a site name that corresponds to a city. So I start pinging these polars, okay, ping Dallas, ping Cleveland. And for the ones that were not available, what you can do is you can use newspapers. Because newspapers, big newspapers, city newspapers, are co-located in the city, usually. And you can tell the ones that aren't, where, you know, the IT part of the newspaper is typically co-located in the city where the newspaper does its primary reporting. So the Denver Post actually has a ping time for us for 50 milliseconds. And that's close enough to 52 that we figured it was Denver. So we went to the carrier and said, why on earth are you failing us over to a path in Denver? And they're like, well, that's just our backup path. I'm like, well, that's not acceptable. Pick a different one. In the meantime, we've changed to a different carrier, so that's sort of irrelevant. So the other thing we have on the wide area network that helps in this situation is we have these wide area network compression appliances, these blue boxes. These are Silver Peaks, and they're pretty cool. They have a number of features that I'll discuss in the next slide. But so what we have here is a brief representation of things. We've got an OC12 between the sites connected through routers, and we have some VPN backup connectivity over the public internet. That's the 22 millisecond path I talked about earlier. And then we have this sort of virtual tunnel through the Silver Peaks that also goes through these firewalls. Because the wide area network is maintained by a separate organization to us, we outsource that capability. And so we set up this tunnel, and it provides a number of advantages. One of those advantages is TCP header compression and optimization. So it'll do things like sliding windows for us automatically. Van Jacobson algorithms, selective acknowledgement, negative acknowledgement, all that stuff it takes care of. So hosts on the endpoints don't have to worry about that. So if you have old Windows or Linux hosts or whatever that somebody forgot to tune, they sort of get that for free. They also do data compression. Think of gzip. For anything that is natively compressible, they will compress the packets, tunnel it across, and pick it up on the other side. They have this thing called network memory. What is network memory? Think of it as, here's a big block of data. I'm going to compute a pretty good checksum on it, like an MB5 or whatever, which is good enough for this application. And then I am going to send this tag and the data to the far side. The far side is going to store both on disk, the tag as an index and the data in this big blob. So that way, when the far side sees another request coming in for the same data, it can say, oh yeah, I have that, and feed it back to the local side. This works really well for us because the latency for both the disks in the Silver Peak and the wide area network connection is around 12 milliseconds. So we don't lose anything in latency by using this appliance, but we gain a lot in QoS features, which is the next thing. And the QoS features are all the typical things you think of from router QoS. You can prioritize things. Like you can say SSH gets higher priority than VNC, which gets higher priority than HTTP, and throw DNS in there, and then throw NFS at the end. So anything left goes to NFS. You can set minimum guaranteed responsiveness for minimum bandwidth for a protocol. You can say, okay, don't bother doing data compression on SSH because that's stupid. It's already pretty random data. If you try to compress it, it will just make it bigger. So you can say, do not compress this data. Send that across as is. You can set these in bypass mode for maintenance. So if you need to upgrade firmware on each, you put them in bypass mode. The traffic just flows through like it's a wire. And they have resiliency to path failure. They also, if you want to pay a lot more money. You can get HA on each end, half automatic failover. And they support alarms and thresholds, which are really useful. So we can tell that some scientist is using, you know, doing a big NFS transfer because we'll see an alarm. We've got staged alarms with warning, you know, high, critical, that indicate, you know, this is the amount of bandwidth that's being consumed. You might want to look into this. Mostly these are advisory because the QoS means the users don't notice. And that's important in this case because we were running on our backup 100 megabit connection for about 4 days. And users, except for those doing fairly large transfers, by and large did not notice because of the QoS. So what did we find? In the end, we had a couple other things happening. These are all mostly happening simultaneously, but you know, there's a little bit of overlap in things, and you get some time while you're waiting for a vendor to respond on one issue to deal with another. We found that there are two transceivers in our data center, one at the provider gear and one at our router. And these transceivers were mismatched. So my theory was, well, you know, let's look at that. What's going on here? The distance between these two pieces of equipment is only about 30 meters, but the carrier has a long-range transceiver, and our outsourced provider has an intermediate-range transceiver. And they're both single mode, so I don't know if you understand the implications of this, but you've got a laser capable of going something like 40 kilometers that's going like 30 meters. So imagine you're talking to somebody and they're just like yelling at you. They're just like, they're at your ear and they're yelling in your ear repeatedly. Well, eventually you're going to go deaf. And that's kind of what happened here. It was a little bit hard to see though, because they were sort of intermittently deaf, right? We could see things were up, the link was sort of bouncing up and down, things weren't great, we were filled over, but things were okay. QoS helped a lot, and it also helps to know your escalation path, because we had to coordinate between multiple organizations. One, the people who run our OC12 long haul, and two, the actual carrier, especially for the optics part. So we had multiple people at different sites at different times looking at this stuff. Come on. Okay, so the next issue, archive failure. So don't try to read this slide. It's not important. The important thing to note is that in a couple places you see really weird looking things. They're like large numbers and the columns don't line up, and I'll go into details on what all this means a little bit. But you can see it's sort of scattered throughout this whole storage array, which has 160 disks in it and they're all 2 terabytes. So what are these things? This is Mega RAID output, and I really hate Mega RAID controllers now, because what's going on here is that these Mega RAID cards are encapsulating the disks as an individual unit. So for every disk you want to pass up to the system, you have to make a logical unit. And because we're using ZFS for this, we like the data integrity properties, we want individual disks. Because if you get a checksum error on a RAID stripe, you don't know which disk is going bad. So having the individual disks presented to ZFS is important. The downside is you have to run a command 160 times to present each disk to the host. And what happened here was that 8 disks, approximately adjacent in the array, disappeared. They just like vanished. And the host said, "Ugh, I don't know what to do. 8 disks are gone." They were spread out, so it kept on working. So Mega RAID forgets about the disks, and then we have these numeric numbers show up, which aren't entirely useful, and we almost lost everything in the recovery process. So I'll go into a little detail about what's going on there. Here's one of the typical RAID 6 groups. You can see a lot of the disks are online. 2 are faulted. You see a subset here at spare 7 where there's a mirror where the spare, there's one spare for the array kicks in and it mirrors to this other thing, but that's unavailable. But all of the stuff on the right, these zeros, they're kind of useful because they indicate there are not actually any data errors on these disks. They're just sort of disappeared.
What's going on? Grant. All right.
So here's what we tried. There's a magic option in ZFS that if you set it in NC system, it's going to launch an FSCK at startup. So we set that. We rebooted the machine, and it didn't help. We tried reseating the disks. That didn't really help either at first. We tried reseating the SAS cables. That didn't help at all. Then we removed the disks. We physically removed the disks from the machine, and we shoved them back in. Well, that did help. What happened then is they went from like totally disappeared to showing up to the card again. And so now we have all of these numeric identifiers that I showed you earlier. And we also did, we used DD at some point to actually overwrite the label on these disks because they're showing up with these funky names. As an attempt to try to get them to re-show up to the operating system. Unfortunately, we discover that we have a namespace collision. And the namespace collision is in this slide. You'll see these identifiers in red here. They say was dev disk C2 T8 D0 S0. Well, initially when we did this, and we tried to do the DD, I said, okay, DD over the beginning of the disk, make Zpool sort of forget about it so that it can discover it again, put a new label on it, make everything cool. Unfortunately, in all of the replacing of things, the mappings changed. So these things in red were actually other disks in the system that were still in use. So we ended up DDing over the labels of disks that were okay. And at this point, we're down 3 disks in each RAID 6 group. One RAID 6 group is down 5 disks. So you're thinking, oh, geez, we're going to have to start restoring from tape at this point, aren't we? But we tried a couple of things. And my colleague Nathan, I don't see him out there. But Nathan managed to get these working with some extreme jujitsu involving more DDs and stuff. And so those disks, plus the Etsy system option and some other things, made the mistakenly DD'd disks reappear to the system after a few reboots, and we're left back in this state. This was dev disk, blah, blah, blah. The problem here is you can't remove these disks from the system because Zpool says, I'm sorry, that disk doesn't exist. Even if you use a numeric, this really long numeric identifier, and you can't re-add these disks to the system with that name because ZFS is saying, I'm sorry, that disk already exists in the pool. So we're in a catch-22. So how we fix this is we use the format-e option, which restores a sort of factory default label to the disk. The DD thing didn't quite work out. We reboot, we launch a scrub. We found that we lost 2 files in snapshot, so not the current version of the file, but an older version of the file. It had bad checksum. It got corrupted. So this is a pretty good outcome overall from this near disaster. And we're back to the original set. And now we figured out that one of these disks that had the weird long number on it was a spare and actually wasn't used. So when we were looking at it before, we didn't check every single disk. So we systematically go through all of these 8 disks, and we find one that we can actually remove. And once we remove that one, we can use that to substitute in for one of the other ones. And once we do that, then that one's free to substitute in one of the other ones. So after a couple of days, 1 terabyte or 2 terabyte disks, they take about 16 hours each, we got everything restored. So we go through this Towers of Hanoi process, and it's all fixed. So what did we learn from this? Was in ZFS output is useful, but don't trust it, because your mapping could have changed. And if you go in under the assumption that that mapping is correct, you can end up in a worse state than you were before. The other thing we discovered is ZFS is able to repair from amazing amounts of admin-inflicted damage. We were really surprised by this, and very pleasantly surprised, I'll grant you. But this is quite a revelation that, you know, you can destroy it so that LUNs are down 5 disks out of 8, and through a little bit of jujitsu, you can fix this, and ZFS will recover, and everything's cool. The only other file system I've dealt with that, there's, I guess, 2 others that I've dealt with that can sort of have this sort of resiliency. And one of those is with VXFS, where you can do all kinds of magic under the hood and swap things around transparently. And to some extent, GPFS, which is sort of like, I don't know if you're familiar with the A10 Thunderbolt, also called the Warthog. This is a plane that you can shoot off parts of it and it keeps on flying. It's kind of what happens. Another thing, another lesson, use RAID cards in ZFS. Use RAID cards that do not require explicit mapping. Use a RAID card that has pass-through. I highly encourage this. You don't want to do all this mapping stuff, because one, if the RAID card forgets about the disk, you've got to re-add it manually. In a pass-through, if the disk disappears for a little while and comes back, it's just transparent. It passes through the host, everything's cool. It's worth the effort to find these. There's a little bit harder to find. There's a Mega SAS or LSI Symbios 8i, which is a really good card for ZFS in general. Double check your mappings for apparently missing disks. This goes back to the was. It's subtly different, so you know, just double check, because things might be not what you expect. And locate lights are helpful, but not necessarily reliable. In this particular setup, the locate light wasn't very useful because it was controlled by the Mega RAID card. You have to run a command on the Mega RAID card to identify the disk. And if that disk is vanished for some reason, then you don't get a locate light. But what you can do is you can put a locate light on the 2 disks on either side. So that's a helpful tip. Issue number 3, application server. These are primary application servers that we have. And these are ZFS boxes. They supply all of our modules. We use the old Tickle module system for providing applications, multiple versions. We have a lot of versions of different things. And these servers aren't exactly HA. They're mirrors of each other, but they're not HA with each other. And we're in the process of working on that even as I speak. But at the time of this failure, they were not. And so one failure takes down a subset of the NFS clients. Now, we're not necessarily a 24/7 shop, so it's, you know, not a dire, you know, with a bank, if something like this happens, you have the HA. So we didn't have this set up initially, and that was an acceptable risk, and now we're fixing it because we don't like it anymore. So one of these is down, and there's no console interaction, so we can't see what's going on. We try to power cycle the thing. It's where you see the BIOS flash screen, it goes back, it gets stuck in the same state. So what's going on? So what do we do? Well, we figured it might be a RAID card. Maybe there's a RAID card failure. That can happen, right? So, I mean, we have a guy, he goes and he pulls each unit out of the rack and pulls the RAID card out of one, swaps them over, pushes them back in. This takes about 45 minutes. Meanwhile, people are stuck. Nothing's going on these machines. And RAID card is replaced, but the problem stays with the initial server, so obviously it's not the RAID card. Okay, what's next? CPUs? No. We kind of go through Brendan's thing. I don't know if you saw it yesterday. We go through, you know, diagnostics, see what's going on. CPUs are okay. Memory's okay. All that stuff is okay. All right, disks. That's all that's left, right? So we've got 2 SSDs in these. These are the ZFS intent log and also the boot disk. We make them do double duty. The boot disk doesn't have much activity going on. So we pull out the first disk, and we try to boot the machine. Nothing. It gets stuck in exactly the same place. So we move on, pull out the second disk. All of a sudden, the machine starts booting. Everything's working. So, okay, one disk causes all kinds of issues. This is interesting. So what did we learn? Well, obviously, keep spares on hand, even for RAID cards. We had them, but it's a useful lesson. Always have spares for everything. If you have a really good RMA, that's not good enough. Even if you have a four-hour response, if you have a spare on site, that's faster than waiting for the four-hour response. Have your spares. Without easy rack maintenance, our downtime would have been a lot longer. The fact that we can pull these servers out without removing them from the rack and replace things like RAID cards, CPUs, and memory would have made the outage probably at least an hour or two longer. So that's a useful lesson. And SSDs are still relatively new technology. It can have really peculiar failure modes. So this one SSD was basically locking up the system. It was totally locking up the SAS bus in this case. So, you know, pay careful attention to these. Newer technology exists all the time. And be aware. So now we get to the fourth issue. This is the big one. This is going to take most of the rest of the talk. And there's a lot of background here. So let's get right to it. What happened? Well, I'll describe a little bit about what we used this thing for. But it happened just after the WAN primary path outage and just prior to the archive outage, which sort of, you know, just snuggled right in there between all the other events that happened in the course of about 3 or 4 days. And these boxes are our main storage for all of the chemistry data that we produce. So we have something like, at this time, about 2 petabytes raw, about 600 terabytes of that is in use. We've got some capacity for growth. We've got some overhead for RAID 6. And we've got a lot of chemistry. All of the supercomputers are dependent on this storage being up because they all dump their chemistry output here. Chemists use this for analyzing the data that comes off the supercomputers. And there are some people's miscellaneous chemistry data directories that live on these. So these are fairly important boxes. We put a lot of effort into the redundancy and the architecture of these. But there are obviously some issues, which I'll get into. These four boxes over here on the left are the Linux nodes that front-end these storage boxes. And these are just standard Linux boxes. You put a lot of memory in them. They have Intel CPUs. They run GPFS. And GPFS' job is to take all of the logical units that are presented from these storage arrays and stripe them together and present them as a file system. And it has a number of other capabilities, too, such as a really powerful policy engine that we use a lot, and automatic failover, so any one of these boxes can fail, another one picks it up transparently. We combine that with CTDB to provide NFS failover, so if one of these boxes fails, NFS automatically fails over to the other. And you can see from the yellow and the blue, which I've highlighted, that they have redundant paths to these two controllers, which are redundant controllers for the storage array. So there's a primary path and a secondary path, and all of these are directly connected. Each shelf has two connections to each controller. I'm sorry. Each shelf has one connection to each controller, so there's a redundant setup. If you think of it as sort of an interleave setup where half the disks are primarily controlled on one controller and half the disks are primarily controlled on the other controller, then they also have a recovery mechanism where if one of the controllers goes down, then those paths can fail over and everything can be controlled by one controller over the other. So this is a fairly redundant setup. These horizontal links are for a chain cabinet we have. We have an expansion cabinet. So the primary shelves, the left half of the primary shelves is connected to the left half of the secondary and so on. And each of these is arranged in a stripe. So these colors represent the stripes. You can see that we've got it's a 10-disk fixed RAID 6 stripe. So that's 8 disks of data, which is a nice multiple power of 2, and that gives it pretty good performance characteristics because of that. And the colors just represent different stripes as you go down through these disks. And a little illustration, you can see how it just sort of, every single column has its own stripe. When you get a disk failure, you pull out that disk from that particular place in that particular shelf. All the shelves are labeled and identified, and you replace that disk and you put it back in. The controllers take care of the rebuild. Everything's cool. So this is an illustration of the ownership. You know how I said that, you know, controller one owns half and controller two owns half. This is sort of a pictorial representation of controller two, in this case, owning half of these disks. Pretty simple. So let's go back to the controllers and drill into these a little bit more detail, because the architecture of these is important for understanding the failure. So what we have here is a controller with five PCI cards, more or less, and each one has two SAS connections. That's 10 total, each one going to a shelf. So you can see one of the points of failure right here, right? You've got two shelves controlled by one SAS card. If that SAS card goes bad, you're down two disks in a RAID 6 group. You're at minimal functionality. Another disk failure results in loss of data. Luckily, they have journals so that if you lose a SAS card, you have a spare, you put it in, you boot the thing back up, the system knows, oh, this RAID 6 group, only these blocks needed to be updated. So it's not the best thing in the world. It's not the worst thing in the world either. This is an older model. It's about 2 years, two generations behind current. But this is their architecture in that particular controller. So let's look at all these possible failure modes, knowing this architecture. First one, GPFS server fails. We talked about that. Any server can recover from any other. It's transparent to all the users. They don't notice. What happens if the fiber channel card fails in a particular Linux head node? Well, if that fiber channel card fails, if you've got, you know, redundant fiber channel cards, then you only lose half the path to one of the head nodes. All of the other GPFS nodes have a notion of redundancy. So everyone is designated primary ownership on one quarter of the disks and secondary ownership on the other three quarters. So we sort of round robin these and say, who owns primary, who owns secondary? If one of the guys says, I can't talk to my disks anymore, another one says, oh, okay, I'll take over now. And, you know, there might be a little bit of a hitch, but things basically move on. Okay, so what happens if a storage controller fails? If a storage controller fails, half of the paths to all shelves are lost, because all of those disks go away. So you have the other path, which now becomes, it stays active for the stuff that it originally owned, and it becomes active for the stuff that it didn't own. But the other downside of this is you lose your RAID 6 journals when that controller fails, because it's stored on the controller for its primary paths. So what happens if the storage shelf SAS card fails? Well, half, there's two of them. There's a right half and a left half. They're interleaved. And half of the disks in that shelf become inaccessible. You replace the card, the journals take over, you get a fast rebuild, things come back up. This is sort of the least problematic of all the failure modes, because you're basically losing half, you know, it's slightly degraded, no big deal. So what happened? We start getting controller one SAS cards throwing a lot of errors. We're seeing these errors in the console, and the users start reporting excruciatingly slow throughput, like really pitiful, like things, a list that takes a half a second is taking them like 45 seconds to run lists. So it's really, really bad. Users are complaining, errors are appearing, and so the normal procedure here is to replace the SAS card in the controller and then reboot the controller. So the primary path for half the disk disappears for a little while, starts to reboot, and then it fails. Fails dead. The controller does not come back. So we replace this controller We get it. It happens to be that it's only like 3 p.m. We make the next business morning shipping date. They send us one overnight. Whoa. You got a little preview there. Anyway, we get it overnight. It's 2 hours after we replace controller one. Things are starting to get, you know, we're still seeing some transient errors on that same SAS card issue. And controller two fails. So now things are flipped around. We have lost all the journals on controller one because that's gone. And then controller two fails. So now we have some new journals from controller one for the stuff in controller two that it takes over for. But things are really kind of weird, and we're starting to panic. We also get more channel errors. Same two channels. The last two channels, last two shelves are still throwing errors. So we get the vendor on the phone, and the vendor says, okay, we want you to power cycle both of these, both of your controllers and the storage shelves. So we do that. We're going through. Everything's fixed. So we have the guy, and we've got two technicians on site because they just replaced controller two, and the vendor says, you know, everybody's on fire right now. Things are just like looking really bad, and we're really worried about this. And we got the guys on site, and they're preparing to power cycle the disk shelves. And I'm watching on the console, and I see, okay, shelf 10 is gone, right? That's expected. Shelf 9 is gone. Okay, cool. And then, oh, gee, there's all this stuff on the console. What is this? Shelf 8? No, wait, who did that? What's going on? Okay, so now we have 3 out of the 2 shelves we intend to go down. As you remember, this is RAID 6. They're striped across shelves. We're thinking we lost all the data. We're going to have to restore 600 terabytes of stuff from tape at this point. And we really kind of panicked. So what happened? Well, at one point, we moved these whole units from one building to another building. And these buildings are a fair distance apart. And when the power cables got plugged back in, the power cables were swapped between shelves 8 and 9. So the guy who was pulling the power out didn't look at the fact that, oh, we should be power cycling the bottom two shelves. If he had done this sort of mental self-check, but this is a stressful situation, I cut him some slack. If he had looked at this, he would have realized that, hey, I shouldn't be pulling this cable. But he was looking at the label on the cable, he pulled it out, and the shelf disappeared. So we did the prudent thing. We did an emergency shutdown on all 4 of the GPFS nodes to try to preserve the integrity of the file system, because we were just seeing errors out the wazoo over the console connection. So next we bring all 3 of these shelves online, and we check for console error messages. We start up the Linux nodes and make sure that they can see all the disks. We check the file system very carefully on each node, one at a time. We bring up, we mount it. You have to bring up 2 minimum. There's a quorum requirement for GPFS. So we bring up 2 nodes, and we get the quorum, and we mount the file system. It's there. We can see files in it. Some directories are showing up flashing red. That's not good, but the file system is there. We can do ls. We can do df. Finally, we have a little bit of a break. We talk to the vendor, and there's a feature in the firmware that says, if there's a third controller failure, don't do anything. Just freeze. Don't do anything because you might cause more problems. So you can't fail an entire third shelf. It won't let you do that. That's a good thing in this case. Now we're back to these transient errors, and we replace an I/O card in a disk shelf. So here's the current status. We've got all of the RAID 6 stripes degraded because of all of these controller issues. As these controller issues come through, they multiply, the controller sees, oh, gee, this sucks. I'm going to mark that offline. One more disk failure out of about 800 and we lose data because GPFS is striping across all of the logical units. So in a stripe, you lose any component of the stripe, it's RAID 0 across all the units, and you've lost everything. Half of the disks have journals available in these RAID 6 stripes, and half don't. These are 90 RAID 6 groups of various sizes. So there's a lot of potential for issues over the next time period. We also have the potential to run an FSCK. We've never done this before. We don't know how long it takes. We don't know what's going to happen. That's a big deal. We're probably going to have to do this because the file system clearly has suffered a fair bit of wrath, if I may use that word, sorry. Can we rebuild with these journals? This is a question we have for the vendor. We don't know. Yeah, okay. So it turns out that we are able to fix half of the RAID 6 stripes journals, and it takes a few hours. That's good. We're able to bring the file system online for users. Even though there's a lot of directories showing up as flashing red, most of the stuff is there. And we test it out, and we can actually write it. We have to make a judgment call here, right? We can either leave this thing offline for an indefinite period of time, impacting the entire company, or bring it online, let the users use it in this degraded, unknown, FSCK, unstable state, and see what happens. So we opt to do this because it's the business, right? I mean, you've got to have the business going. It turns out we can do things. There's one issue, and that's that every once in a while, when somebody is making a directory on a particular Linux NFS node, it goes against a particular bit of metadata somewhere in the file system, discovered that the mirrored copy of that is corrupted, and the make dir fails. So we write a script in cron to catch this, to look for this condition, to like, you know, actually it wasn't even in cron, it was just a daemon, it was tailing the log file, it's looking for like a particular IO error that indicates a make dir. And then when that happens, we shut down GPFS on that node. That node fails over the other nodes, and they keep on running. So we have this script running on all the nodes. They're intermittently popping in and out, but they're serving the file system, and things are going okay. And the data is being created, and users are able to use it. So we announce it to the users. We check the cluster status very carefully. And things are going. We also apply QoS. This isn't the same Silver Peak QoS. This is just like on the router, please limit the number of megabytes per second to this net block destination or network. We have all the clusters divided into consistent net blocks, and we know which ones are the big ones. The analysis cluster is well defined. So we put in a little QoS there. It says, please limit the analysis cluster from anything they want to 200 megabits per second per redundant link. So they can still do analysis. It's sort of sucky, but they can do it. The important thing is that the Antons are able to write data. They're the most expensive computing tool in the enterprise, and if they're running, things are mostly okay. And if people can hobble by and do other stuff, that's cool. So both controllers are busy rebuilding, but the maximum number of LUNs that they can rebuild is 6. And there are 45 to build. So we're pondering this and wondering what's going on. So we have to pray for no disk failures in 2 to 3 works of rebuilds across half of all of the disks in the system, or we lose all of the data and we have to restore from tape. And then we realized that because of our policy engine, a lot of that data is on MAID storage. That second cabinet I showed you way back in the beginning, we use MAID to put that stuff in low power mode. We have a very defined workflow. Chemists run stuff in the supercomputer. They look at it for a few weeks to a few months, and then they move on to the next job. It's very staged, so we have a policy that says, find me anything that hasn't been accessed or read in the last 90 days, move it to the MAID shelf, they power on automatically, the MAID shelves, the MAID cabinet, and then After 30 minutes of activity, they go back to sleep. So those discs have been sleeping this entire time. So we're thinking, well, gee, why can't we just go in and mark those shelves as okay? That would get us back the worst of the data, because these are the largest RAID sets. They're on 2 terabytes and 3 terabyte discs. So, you know, they're 16 terabyte or whatever LUNs after overhead. So we approached the vendor with this. And that's breaking down. And we tell them, made disks are not being written, and can you help us out here? And they said, oh, well, actually, there's this undocumented command that we can give you, but you have to promise, you have to really promise us that you know what you're doing. You're doing this at your own risk. We're not going to guarantee anything. Are you absolutely 100% sure that there was no data being written? You know, we think a little bit, and we're like, well, not. Talk to ourselves, we're like, well, are we really sure? Well, we're about 95% sure, but we tell the vendor, yes, we're absolutely 100% sure that no data is being written. And this is great. They say, okay, here's the command, run this. I'm like, yes. So we start running this, and no. We have an issue. The problem is that the command reports that there's outstanding rights to these disks, and I'm sorry, you can't run this command. So we go to the vendor and we'll say, well, what does this mean? And they say, well, you had rights. I'm like, but we didn't have rights. And I said, are you sure you didn't have rights? And we said, absolutely, we're sure we didn't have rights. So it turns out there's this other command. What we theorized here, this is our theory, and it turned out to be true. It could have not been true, and we would have been really screwed, but it turned out to be true in this case. That what happened was when we did a shutdown on the GPFS nodes, that some key bit of metadata was trying to be replicated to these disks. This is plausible, right? You shut down the file system normally. What we probably should have done is just flick the switch and turn all these things off. But we did a shutdown, and it tried to do stuff, and it may have tickled super block replicas or whatever sits out in these disks. Very minor thing. So we go back to the vendor and say, okay, what do we do? And they say, all right, send us some debug output. Should be a few thousand lines. So we run this command. It generates 128,000 lines from each controller. And I'm like, did you give me the right command? Because I know you said it was going to be a couple thousand lines. And they said, well, yeah, it should be. And I said, this is 128,000 lines from each controller. And I said, oh, well, just send it in. Don't worry about it. So I send in the data. They've got this model storage shelf, their guru in the back end. He looks at this data. He runs some script on the thing. And he says, oh, yeah, I see you've got these bits set in this bitmap. And if we run a particular command for every one of these bad bits and flip it around, then we can correct the bitmap. And then you can go back and run the command that failed. So we do that. So I write an expect script. He gives me this long list of disks and this long list of bits to step, and we're stamping out, dunk, 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 correcting all these things one at a time. Those are hams, by the way. I kind of like this picture. They're stamping hams. And we start to see the light here, because this is working, and we get all of these disks online. Now we're only degraded in about 30 of our RAID 6 LUNs, still by 2 disks, but we're a lot better off than we were before. So we wait. Excuse me. So with some help from expect, we rebuild all this stuff, the made parity is rebuilt, and we continue to run with the network throttles in place. And 5 days later, one disk out of every RAID 6 column is rebuilt. Another failing in this architecture is when you're down by 2, you know, in most RAID architectures, you're down by 2, the sensible thing to do is rebuild both at the same time. You've got all the data. You know what needs to be written. Just rebuild both. It's not how this works. This thing only rebuilds one at a time. So we rebuild one, and after 5 days, we sort of, you know, have a little sigh, because now no longer is it the case that one disk failure makes us lose all the data. We don't lose a single disk in all this time. We don't have any more FC errors. We have a little bit of fortune, and things are cool. Out of panic mode. So after 14, so then we run an MFFCK. This is a great tattoo, by the way. It's real. I don't know. Can you see that okay? Yeah, it's crap. Somebody put tattoo of crap on their back, right? So the vendor says, okay, now run your FSCK. So we run the FSCK, and after 14 hours, the FSCK comes back and gives this really cryptic error message and says, I'm sorry, I can't continue. It's in phase two. Phase two of what? We have no idea. We haven't run an FSCK before. We asked the vendor. They're like, well, it depends. Oh, okay, great. So what does this mean? Well, it means you need to run an offline FSCK. You have to take your file system offline, run FSCK, and just wait for it to be done. Right? So this is great. We politely decline. We say, no. You tell us what this error message means. What is this error message? There's an error message here. Tell me what it means. Well, I don't know what it means. We'll find somebody who does. Get me somebody who knows what the error message means. So they go back to IBM and they launch a SEV1 ticket, and IBM says, well, that looks like a bug. That looks like a bug in FSCK. We suggest you upgrade the software. Okay, we can do that. It's not so bad. This is better than we were before. This is not like swapping out pieces of hardware and praying. This is like, okay, each one of these GPFS heads is redundant with respect to all the others. So you can take each one offline, upgrade the software in place, and then bring it back online. So we do this entirely online. We don't take the file system offline. And then we run another online FSCK, and we're watching. 12 hours goes by, 14 hours goes by, 16 hours goes by, 24 hours goes by, phase three. Excellent! We're in phase three. And then we get to phase four, and everything's cool. So it works. And I thought this guy represented somebody who's sort of tired and happy and content and maybe a little bit full as his belly's bulging. He's probably had some, you know, fish or something. And so this is sort of how we feel. We're like, oh, God, because this is well after all the other disasters are over. And we're like, oh, wow. Okay, so we remove the throttles, and users are happy again. So things are recovered. It's back to normal. It's cool. So what do we learn from this? All right, explore all of your failure modes. Some of them may be surprising. Some of them, if you chain them together, may be disastrous, right? Evaluate the odds. What are the odds of these things happening? That wouldn't have helped us. You should do it anyway, but it wouldn't have helped us. What are the odds that while a card is going, that a controller will go? And then 2 hours later, after you've replaced the first one, that the other controller will go. What are the odds of that? Well, we don't know. Insist on on-site spares for components that can leave you in severely degraded states. Before this, those controllers, the vendor, you know, these are listed as probably $150,000 a piece items. They don't typically let you on-site spare them. But we had them on the phone for a while, and we said, hey, you're going to give us a spare for that. Oh, we don't typically do that. I know, you're going to do it anyway. So they did. They shipped us a spare. We have a spare $150,000 controller sitting in the room in case the controller fails. Because waiting 24 hours, worst case, over a weekend, right? They don't ship on the weekends. If it fails Friday night, you're waiting until Tuesday to get that replacement. That's not good. Never defer label maintenance on critical systems. Right? We learned this. But more importantly, don't trust the labels that you do have. Do a verification. If the guy who was pulling the power had thought about it for a little while, you know, take a deep breath. You're in a crisis. It's okay. Take a deep breath. Take stock of your situation. Do an assessment. What's going on? Does this thing I'm about to do, is it the right thing to do? Does it match what I know about the environment? What do I know about the environment? I know that two shelves are failed. I know that my coworker here is helping me pull power on these two shelves. I know that these two shelves are at the bottom of this rack because I personally replaced that controller card. I did these things, therefore I know. And if he hadn't been stressed out, okay, this guy's, he gets a little stressed. He's a part-time guy. He's got another agenda outside of work, and that's okay. And he's gone off the caffeine since then. He's an interesting fellow. But don't trust those labels. Confirm, verify, re-verify. And router and switch-based throttles are very useful for you. You can use these to limit bandwidth in an emergency. So be friends with your networking group. Ask them to help. In our case, we're everything. We're the network, we're the infrastructure, we're the storage, so just put on the router throttles. But a lot of bigger organizations have separation. Be friends with those guys. They can help you. Prepare this beforehand, test it out. Contact your networking guys. Hey, I want to test some router throttles to see what happens. You can throttle by port, protocol, whatever. If you've got firewalls, you can be even more granular. So then we have some more meta-ponderables, right? Our only really true loss, we didn't lose any data out of this, we think. I mean, this is a lot of data, right? We think that we didn't lose any data. We had to restore all those flashing red directories. We had to restore a lot of stuff from tape. And some of it we couldn't really find. Hello. My little remote control is doing things. So, his time. He was restoring all of this data onto another set of old storage because you remember I talked about our workflow and our working set is relatively small. So he was busy restoring from tape all of the most recently last 90-day written stuff to alternate storage so that if we needed to, we could, you know, reboot a bunch of things, rejigger all the NFS, point users at that. And in fact, some of the stuff, we came up with this incredible hack for these directories that were screwed up while everything was operational. And we said, hey, if we change that mount point, and we can't restore that data in place because it says I/O error, but people still want to use it. So we take this data and we restore it from tape in a directory and we make the top level directory with a whole lot of symlinks back to the original place for everything else, but the directory that has the flashing red we replace with data. And so we develop this sort of tree of symlinks and data to sort of patch around the inconsistencies in the file system. And we ended up with a lot of stuff in Lost and Found, but it turned out that nobody really needed it. So did we lose data? We may have lost data. Did we lose important data? We don't think so. What else did we learn? How much do you communicate to management in a failure? Okay? Why is this important? What do I mean by this? Well, when you're going to management knows when everything's broken, obviously, because people are complaining, and they're complaining to us, they're complaining to them. They know that everything's broken. They don't always know how broken everything is. Now, you've got a choice at this point. You can tell them, hey, guess what? If we lose one more disk out of 600, we've lost all our data. Or we can say, things are really bad. We're working on it really, really hard, and I'll get back to you really soon. So we took sort of a middle path in there. Like, okay, yeah, things are really bad. Some critical failures could result in us having to restore everything, but we didn't say one disk out of 600. That's the key bit. You know? So you've got to make that decision. And in some cases, you can't really make that decision. So don't make a bad career move when things are on the line. This wasn't a bad career move for us. I mean, we communicated. The balance is, how much indigestion do you want to give your manager, right? Now, some people just like to give their manager indigestion, and some have like full formal reviews where you have to lay it all out, right? So if you've got a formal review process and you have to lay it all out, by all means, do so. But if you can, you know, tell people things are bad without giving the details that give them knots in their stomach, that's a useful thing, if you can. You've got to make the decision for yourself whether to leave storage online or take it offline. We decided that we were going to bring this storage online as soon as we could because it was semi-critical to the organization to do so. We've had other outages where we said, we're going to leave this offline until it's fixed because that's really important to do because, you know, the vendor told us or whatever they said. In this case, they recommended that we do it offline, but they didn't say, absolutely, you have to take it offline. We had another case where the vendor said, you absolutely must take this offline. You don't have any choice. You've tested your backups recently, right? How many people have recently tested their backups? Homework, right? Those of you who didn't raise your hand, homework. You should do that. Everybody says that, really. It's valuable. Is your tape data or other backups, you may have disk backups, something that can be easily restored? Are you optimizing for backups or are you optimizing for recovery? If you're optimizing for backups, your recovery may be much longer than you want. If you're optimizing for recovery, your backups may be harder and take longer, but in a disaster, you'll be able to recover faster. The last thing we thought about was, okay, so we had these four things happen at the same time. What are the commonalities between them? How did this happen? So the first thing we thought of is, okay, well, could it have been dirty power? And we thought about this for a while, and we discounted this one really early because these are in the clusters and the storage are in two completely separate data centers. The archive box is in one place. The application servers are in one place. This big storage thing is in a totally different place. They're on totally separate substations from the electrical grid. They run on online UPSs directly off of battery / generator in one case or flywheel in the other case. So no, dirty power's out. It's not that. Okay, what about power surges, lightning in the area? Well, for similar reasons with, you know, the fact that these are running off of UPS and not off of active line power, we ruled that out. So then one of the guys saw my login article about this, and he says, hey, have you thought about solar flares? And I'm like, oh, that's an interesting idea. Could it have been solar flares? Well, they can go right into the infrastructure, right? They can sort of, you know, permeate. They interact at a higher level than going directly through the power line. They can come in but the thing about solar flares is they usually have other apparent effects. For instance, flickering fluorescent lights, right? So we didn't think it was solar flares, and I actually, after he contacted me, I said, So I did a Google search and I said, show me solar flare history for January of 2012. And there were no solar flares during this time period, so it wasn't a solar flare. Could have been, it's plausible, but it wasn't. Gremlins, could it have been a gremlin? All right, maybe not this guy. How about this guy? Could it have been this guy? Well, the gingerbread man, I love this, it's topical. I can't, you know, Google found this. It's like, hey, cool, Christmas, gremlin. Yeah, well, who knows, maybe. How about just, you know, freak natural disaster? Bad luck. Was it just bad luck? I don't know. This is a real picture from Athens, Ohio. This is like the definition of bad luck right here. Boulder falls on your car in your driveway. There's another great one. In Bayonne, New Jersey, in 2007. I remember reading this in the newspaper. Or maybe it was online. I don't remember. But what happened was, these women were having sort of a tea on their porch or whatever, and all of a sudden, one of them notices her car is parked out front, and it's caught on fire. And so she calls the fire company, and they come out and figure out what happened is there was a squirrel chewing on a power line directly over top of the car. It bit into the power line, caught on fire, fell onto the car, somehow dropped into the engine compartment, and burned up the entire car. Squirrels are dangerous. Squirrels are the worst natural disaster in IT history. Do a search sometime. Do the search, or seriously, run this search on Google. Squirrel burns car. You'll find stuff about churches burning. You'll find stuff, the Bayonne incident. You'll find all kinds of stuff about squirrels. We had a substation power outage once because a squirrel chewed through a ground wire. So, you know, whenever we have a power outage, one of the things we always ask the upstream people was it a squirrel? About half the time it is. That's the funny part. How about highly localized subspace disturbance? Or, you know, any of the favorite enemies, Q, Kardashians, whatever, who knows? All right, we don't know. Chupacabra. Maybe it was the chupacabra. We don't really know. Anyway, I've got some time for another one, but I figure I'll open up for questions. Thanks. Anybody? No questions? All right. I do have another story. So I'm a big Douglas Adams fan, as I'm sure many of you are. I don't have any visuals for this one, but I figured I might have time for one, so I threw this in. This is another GPFS issue. We have these new GPFS servers, and they have more memory. We bought these things with 288 gigs of RAM because the more memory you throw at GPFS, the more caching you get, and the better things work. So we're going to install these GPFS boxes, and we want to carefully do this. We use Jumpstart to, you know, Kickstart, sorry, to install Red Hat servers. So we carefully go to the what I didn't show you in that architecture is we have a separate set of boxes for our metadata. They're mirrored on Texas memory systems to provide high speed for policy engine executions. And we wanted to do an install and test things to make sure that a kickstart wasn't going to screw things up, because I don't know if many of you probably have experience with Kickstart. It tends to say, if you don't explicitly tell me that I don't own something, I assume that I do, right? Like, that chair is mine unless somebody tells me it isn't, right? That's my chair. Somebody prove me wrong. That's my chair. So this is how Red Hat works. So we carefully set up this environment. We go to the fiber channel switch. I set the ports on the switch to be read-only. And then we do the install, things are going along, and then like 3 minutes later, I start seeing all these error messages from the file system about like bad inodes and IORs. I'm like, oh crap, what's going on? No, this can't be related. Can it? What's going on? My coworker's installing the box. Wait, when we put these, before this last, you know, before the big incident, we had learned that all of our metadata was not mirrored. So when the vendor came out to do the initial setup, we only had one copy of the metadata. They were supposed to set up with mirrored. So we bought new Texas memory systems. And while we were setting it up, we changed the physical architecture so that both of these boxes were connected to both fiber channel switches. And I had put the lockouts on one of the TMS boxes, but not the other, which was also connected to that same switch. So even though the host was only connected to one switch, it had a path to both TMSs. So my coworker notices, hey, this is taking a lot longer than it should. What's going on? And he goes to the console and he says, whoa, what is that disk? SD like D? No, what? And so he stops it, and I'm like, oh, this is like one of those oh shit moments, right? You know, we have just put ext4 on top of metadata. Crap. Right? So, we contact the vendor. What happened? Oh, we put ext4 on top of the metadata. Why'd you do that? Well, we didn't mean to. It just happened. We didn't want to put ext4 on top of our metadata. So I don't know how, if you know how, and much about how ext4 works. It sort of sprinkles its magical bits all through the disk, right? I mean, it puts like the super block, and then it makes replicas. So in our metadata, we have these ext4 woodpecker holes in various parts of the metadata scattered around. But we've got to recover this thing. The stuff is, you know, mirrored, but the file system is damaged because some of that stuff went bad, and we've got to figure out which mirror went bad, the primary or the secondary, because the software is sort of interleaving primary and secondary, and it can't automatically correct. This is sort of this classic Byzantine agreement problem, right? You've got two things. One of them is bad. How do you know which one? So we get the IBM support guy on a WebEx, and he's looking at this. He's like, oh, this is not good. This is not good. So we're on the phone for like 4 hours, and he's like, oh, gee, I don't know what to do about this. Wow, how did you do this again? ext4. Why did you do that? No. Forget the why. How do we fix it? So this guy's like a real GPFS guru. And he says, all right, I think I know what we can do. What we're going to do, pay attention to this. This is really kind of cool hackery. He says, we're going to create this several hundred megabyte file in GPFS. We're going to put the file system in debug mode. We're going to see the blocks, which disk that's on, and what's the offset from that disk of where these blocks are created. We're going to make it such that it's only on one disk. And then we're going to remove that file from the file system. But the blocks are still there. And now, we're like many hours into this. He says, okay, and like, actually, this is over the course of a week, because he spends a week looking at this stuff, and then another week, and we're running in this crazy sort of degraded metadata mode. And we come back, and he's doing this on the weekend, because I have to take it offline, and he's like doing the old equivalent of poke and peek, right? He's saying, okay, I'm running TSDBFS, and you know, looking and drilling down into the file system and looking at, you know, it's sort of interleaved, so like the primary and secondary. And he's looking at the, we DD off the data from each block to figure out which one is good and which one is bad. Because you don't really know. You have to like look at it. So we look at it, he brings up Emacs, and he's looking at this stuff in Emacs, and he's saying, well, that's clearly GPFS data. Really? I mean, to me, it's, you know, ones and zeros, right? It's like, this is clearly GPFS data. It's apparently got a pattern that he's seen before. So, and then this stuff over here, I don't know what that is. So we're going to take this one and replace that one. But we can't replace that one directly. So we're going to take this one and make a copy of it over here on this file that I just removed at a particular offset using DD, seek, and count, and make copies and put them at a particular offset in this file. Then we're going to patch the inode in the file system to say, now use that copy. And then when he's done, he runs a command that says, like, OK, I think this is good. Apply. So we apply to this file system. And then he says, OK, now we need to run an FSCK. How long is that going to take? I don't know. It's going to take as long as it takes. So we run an FSCK, and we're thinking, okay, this is going to take maybe 48 hours, the rest of the weekend. This is, by the time he's done with this is late Saturday afternoon. So the file system is online. We've scheduled the downtime. We're down for the weekend. We run the FSCK, and I'm watching it, and I like take my computer and set it on the bedside table, and every once in a while I get up and log in and look at the computer, like, still running, all right, back to bed. And so Sunday goes by, it's still running, I send out an update, hey, the file system's still offline, we expect it. The IBM engineer strongly recommends that we let this pass complete. After that, we can interrupt. He only was like one strongly recommends we let it run to completion, and then like it was like triple strongly recommends we let this pass complete, because it will recover, but it's gonna start over, and you're gonna have to wait another 24 hours to get to this point. So we let it run, and Monday morning, I'm looking at, this is one of those like Windows-ish completion things. You're looking at this FSC key output, right? And the last 2% takes like 40% of the time. So it gets to 90%, and you can look at the output. It says it prints stamps in like 10-minute intervals, and the 10-minute intervals keep resulting in less and less and less stuff getting done. So the last, like once you get to 98%, it's going at 0.02% per 10 minutes. So we're like, ugh. And this is just a sort of non-deterministic. We just have to let it run. Late on, I think we even went, late on Monday night, it finally ended. We had to interrupt it. So now we know that the following weekend, we have to do another FSCK, because we've got to let this thing complete. But we got some errors out of the FSCK. So we send these errors into the IBM guy. And he says, oh, now we have to do some more patching. So we go through the same, we're going to make a file, we're going to delete the file, we're going to DD stuff into the file, we're going to patch the file system. At one point, he looked at the metadata and he said, I don't know which one of these is good. Do you have any feel for it? I'm like, well, most of them have been the left half, so let's go with the left half. All right, we'll do the left half. So we did that. He does that. We run another FSCK. It comes back, cleans up a lot of files, and it finishes, and everything's cool, and we're like, oh, crap. But that's not the end of it, because then we want to repeat this process a month later, right? And we go to reinstall this Linux node that's connected to one switch. We correct the FC zoning. That's cool. And no, did we? No, we didn't. We didn't correct the FC zoning at this point. We thought we did. We go to do this, but we do it like a manual install. It's a manual install. It's not kickstart. So we do the manual install. Don't let kickstart touch this stuff. We start doing things. We reboot the node. How many people familiar with MD RAID? You know how MD RAID works? Who knows how MD RAID works when it sees a label? Anybody? MD RAID is, yeah, go ahead. It assumes ownership. He's right. MD RAID says, hey, I've got this label here. It was created by ext4. GPFS is putting its metadata sparse. Those ext4 bits are still out there. They're not interfering with GPFS, but they're there. And MD RAID says, hey, I see this thing over here. It's supposed to be mirrored to this other thing over here. Let me help you with that. That's it. That's all. Thanks.